This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. I want you to imagine for a moment the Earth not as a rocky ball, but as a giant bar magnet. And our bar magnet Earth is circling a much bigger bar magnet, the Sun. Now imagine the enormous magnetic bubbles, the fields created by these two magnets, bumping and scraping and pushing against each other. How's that working out? To understand that shoving match a quartet of spacecraft is surfing those magnetic waves, and they've beamed back a few clues, reported this week in the journal Science. My next guest has that story and other selected short subjects in science. Amy Nordstrom is an associate editor at the IEEE Spectrum here in New York. Welcome back.
Hi, Ira.
So what are the spacecraft out there doing?
So the spacecraft that we're talking about, they're part of a NASA experiment called MMS, and they are exploring this phenomenon known as magnetic reconnection. And this is a phenomenon that occurs in the interaction between the magnetic fields that the Earth has that protects us from the solar winds coming off of the Earth and those carried by the solar winds in our direction. So when these solar winds hit the magnetosphere of the Earth, they collide and form this big crash in these forces of charged particles. And in some cases, the magnetic forces from those two fields will actually connect with each other. And we call this a magnetic reconnection. And this is the phenomenon that scientists have known about for a while. They've theorized about how it occurs. They've observed its effects in phenomena here on Earth, like the aurora. But they've never really gotten a close look at it before. And that's what this experiment's all about.
So they add up? They connect? Like a tunnel?
Right.
Open up a tunnel?
So usually the forces are traveling in what you can think of as opposite directions.
Yeah.
So it's almost like the researcher I spoke with, James Drink, for the University of Maryland, he described it as two trains traveling in opposite directions. And then their tracks suddenly switch and become one, and they crash into each other for a brief moment. So this can last for a little while before the fields return to their respective opposite directions. But while it does happen, it creates this huge release of energy.
Right.
And that's what the scientists are trying to observe with these spacecraft.
Wow. So that would affect space weather.
Absolutely. So the charged particles that come in from the sun and these solar winds actually make their way into our magnetosphere during these events. And that's what we see in the aurora and a number of other phenomena, like, you know, you've heard maybe of satellites and power grids actually getting knocked out by magnetic storms and big geomagnetic storms. And that's what we're talking about here. So they're hoping by taking a closer look and getting their first observations from within one of these events, they might eventually be able to predict some of these storms happening and give us a little bit of a heads up.
Yeah, because we depend so much now, right?
Yes.
On radio waves, all kinds of waves. We're wirelessly connected.
This radio show depends on it.
It does. Wow. Is it a little box with wires in front of me?
Absolutely.
Well, let's move on to your next story. It's about a prehistoric find under the sea. You don't hear much about finds under the sea, do you?
So this is a very interesting site in Florida that was just recently discovered and reported today in Science Advances. So this site in Florida is about 45 minutes from Tallahassee. It actually is in a river. So the stone tools and the mastodon bones that archaeologists found at this site were 30 feet underwater and required some special techniques to excavate them. The other interesting thing about these fossils and the stone tools especially are that they have been dated back to 14,550 years ago.
14,000, you said?
Yes.
And years ago.
Yes. And if you've been following archaeology, you know there's a big debate within the field about when humans first arrived in the Americas. And for a long time, the theory was that it was roughly 13,000 years ago humans came over the land bridge. But now we're seeing more and more sites pop up throughout the Americas, including this new one, that suggests that maybe humans might have been here before.
You can't get much further from the land bridge than Florida.
Yes.
Right?
So in Chile, Monteverde is another site that's older, so that is much further away. So that might open up the possibility of a different route. Maybe they didn't come over from the land bridge. Maybe they came by sea in some way, shape, or form.
Were these the Clovis people?
So the Clovis people were the ones that for a long time were thought to be the first humans in North and South America, and they were the ones who were theorized to come over from the land bridge. But these new sites would be pre-Clovis,
wow.
So they would be before.
That's exciting.
Yes.
Yeah. This week you wrote about the next generation in cellular data. Get ready for 5G.
It's an exciting moment to be a wireless engineer. This has been referred to as the Halley's Comet of wireless engineering. You only see it come around once or twice within the course of your entire career if you're working in this field. So your phone and my phone right now, they're working at about 4G LTE service. And then a lot of places, they're still relying on 2G and 3G. But we're trying to work to get to 5G in the next couple of years. But to do this, we need about 1,000 times more capacity on the spectrum that we're using than we have today. And so in order to work toward this, there's been some experiments lately in trying to increase the spectrum efficiency, which you can think of as the number of users that you can cram into a radio channel at once. This week, a couple of researchers at the University of Bristol in England and then also from Lund University in Sweden reported a new world record on spectrum efficiency. They were able to transfer 22 users at once on a single radio channel. So that gets us a little bit closer, and we'll be watching this to see, you know, how much more they can improve that over the next couple of years.
Now, is this for voice or is this for data?
So this is for data, and this is achieved through a technology called Massive MIMO, MIMO, M-I-M-O. And it's achieved using a lot of different antennas, a huge array of antennas. There's 128 of them, and your typical base station only has about 4. So you can imagine what an increase, what a boost this gives you in this huge array of antennas. And this is one of the technologies that's being tested out as potentially pointing the path forward for 5G.
So it's not just jamming a bunch of antennas together. You have to get the algorithm changed.
And right.
The software has to be changed, too.
So the tricky part when you add all these antennas in is you have to be able to route the signals properly, and that can be a really difficult process. So there's a lot of sophisticated signal processing algorithms that need to be written in order to make sure that these signals, these 22 signals traveling on the same channel, are getting to the right spot.
And Facebook is involved. So trying to get this working,
yes.
Right?
Facebook is trying a different array that has about 96 antennas, and it's called Aries. And they reported another record about a month ago for new spectrum efficiency. So they're trying to use it for a slightly different purpose. They actually want to use it to distribute internet out to rural areas from cities, but it's a similar technology.
Well, we can't wait for that. You know, it's all Wi-Fi. Everything's going. Phone calls are all going Wi-Fi now. Are you doing FaceTime and all this other stuff?
Right. I think, you know, 5G service will be really great for those of us who get it. I think we can expect to see it in cities first, and then the rural areas will likely follow after that.
Yeah. All right. That's terrific. Thank you very much for
taking
time to be with us. Amy Nordrum, associate editor at the IEEE Spectrum here in New York. And now it's time to play Good Thing, Bad Thing. Because every story has a flip side. Now we go back to 2014. A strange disease begins affecting sea stars, starfish, off the Pacific coast. A gruesome wasting disease that infected some 90% of the sea stars in the area. And now it appears that some starfish are making a comeback. Or are they? Here to talk about the good and the bad of the sea star saga is Lasana Lahner. She's a veterinarian at the Seattle Aquarium. She's at KUOW Studios in Seattle. Welcome back.
Thank you so much for having me.
So is there good news here?
Yeah, there is good news. There are reports that there's some baby sea stars being seen along the coast. So that is the good news. However, the bad news is that we did experience similar numbers of baby sea stars last spring. And unfortunately, by around midsummer, when these guys reached dinner plate size, they did start to succumb to sea star wasting disease as well. So we are cautiously optimistic about the potential resurgence of sea stars and sea star populations at this time.
Well, you know, you had such a small few words for the good news, and you were right.
I know.
You were right to the bad news.
I know. I'm sorry. I know. Well, it's good news if you're a sea otter. So on that side of things, sea otters eat sea urchins and sea stars eat sea urchins. So if you're a sea otter, you're going to have a lot more groceries right now, because we do know that sea urchin populations have increased along the coast without their primary predator, sea star.
Yeah.
So it is good news for them.
Well, do you have to wait to see if when they grow up, as you say, that they'll, you know, they'll survive or not? It's too early to tell.
It is, and it seems like there is an age for this disease. It seems like younger sea stars are not as susceptible, and once they reach roughly 10 centimeters in diameter, they seem to be more susceptible to sea star wasting disease.
Mm-hmm. Now, when you were here last time, you were talking about signs that a virus was to blame for this wasting disease. Is that still the thought now?
You know, we're still working on the viral component, and Dr. Ian Hewson at Cornell is still doing some amazing work on that. There's still a lot to learn. And I know when I talk to my sister, who's a physician, she says, you know, why are you still working on this? You know, if this were one of my patients, I hate to say it, but I'd have it figured out. So
easy for her to say.
I know, exactly. So I have to remind her of two main things. Number one, we don't know what's normal or baseline health for C-STARS. So I've been working a lot on that. And then number two, C-STARS actually don't have health insurance. So we also have to figure out ways to support this work. So I've been busy looking at what is normal C-STAR blood work and what is the blood look like when it's diseased. And those kind of changes are actually incredibly valuable for helping us figure out what's happening with these guys.
Well, couldn't the C-STAR be sort of a canary in the coal mine for the oceans there?
Exactly, exactly. So just like we look at coral and the fact that coral bleach in response to a variety of factors, heat, even cold, pollution, all of those things cause coral to bleach. And coral don't have many ways to show that they're diseased or stressed. Sea stars are probably very similar. They don't have a multitude of ways to show us that their environment is changing and they're not doing well in that environment. So we have to look closely at what's changing in the environment that might be exacerbating or causing them to waste.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because it's very rarely one thing. It's always some stressor there, right?
Exactly, especially in the marine environment where these guys are bathed in different viruses and bacteria all the time and really rely on a very unique water chemistry to stay healthy. So it's a challenging thing to figure out these wildlife diseases, particularly when they're underwater.
Well, Doc, thanks for taking the time to be with us today.
Well, thank you so much.
Dr. Lizanna Lahner, a veterinarian at the Seattle Aquarium. We're going to take a break, and when we come back, it's time to talk about the birds and the bees. Not in the way you think we're going to talk about them, but an even much more interesting way. We're going to celebrate spring science, talking about how you might track a bee and watch a single bird, and with two very big biologists joining us. So stay with us. We'll be right back after this break. This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. How many times have you seen a group of wild birds and wondered if you could just follow one of them for weeks at a time, observe their habits, their nesting skills, sort of like adopting one as a companion? Well, that's exactly what my next guest has done, and he's written a book about his experiences. And he's here to share with us his love of birds and the stories he's seen play out from his cabin in Maine. Bernd Heinrich is a biology professor emeritus at the University of Vermont. He is the author of One Wild Bird at a Time, Portraits of Individual Lives. And if you have a personal experience with our fine-feathered friends, give us a call at 844-724-8255. You can tweet us at SciFry, S-C-I-F-R-I. Welcome back to the program, Professor.
Thank you.
This is, let me just say, it's a beautifully written book, and your hand illustrations are terrific.
Thank you.
Let's talk about, it sounds like up there in Maine, you're living in a bird watcher's paradise.
Well, birds, they're just about everywhere, even in Central Park in New York.
What kind of birds have you been seeing this spring?
Oh, well, they're just flooding in right now. We just had a northern oriole come to the hummingbird feeder yesterday, the first one, and we've had the hermit thrush back and the blue-headed vireos, and the robin's been here a long time, the woodcock's been here a long time. Lots of turkeys. There's just no end.
Yeah, but you know what's interesting? In your book, you treat one bird at a time. You observe, I mean, whether it's a crow or whether it's a yellow-bellied sapsucker. Mm-hmm. I mean, you have incredible stories of how you take out your pen and your paper and your pencil and you sit with a notebook and you watch one bird at a time.
Yeah, I've been here in the same spot for a long time. You get to observe special individual birds after a while. You know, they have individual personalities, they have individual habits. I mean, for example, like the flicker that built its nest in my house and started to make a hole, and I let him in, basically, and Zoe could watch it from the beginning of the nesting season to the end. And so just watching birds, especially when they're nesting, you can identify the individuals and some at the bird feeder who keep coming every day. So that makes it fun to find out the process of finding things out by mm-hmm. watching the individuals is a lot of fun.
Yeah, that flicker, that's kind of a woodpecker, right?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
And I remember you tell the story that it started punching a hole in the side of the house, and instead of chasing it away, you got your buzzsaw out, and you cut out a hole on your side of the wall so you could watch it build the nest and the whole family of birds.
Exactly, yeah. When I saw him, I heard this tapping on the wall. I said, what the hell is that? And then every time I looked, went out, I saw a flicker fly away, and eventually looked, and there was a little hole he was starting to make. And I said, well, this is an opportunity I don't want to miss, seeing the home life from you know, right up close. So, you know, I got my chainsaw out and took out a piece of the wall on the other side, and I could darken it out on that side. And so I got to see everything from the laying of the eggs to the fledging of the young, you know, just from 2 feet away by just sitting right there. So this was a perfect opportunity to start this thing about watching individual birds.
Mm-hmm. You know, and I was particularly taken with the crows you wrote about, because I've seen crows around all the time. Mm-hmm. And I have watched them when I play golf actually steal a golf ball. Mm-hmm. You're looking for your golf ball. It's not there because a crow mm-hmm. took it. And they just seem so intelligent and so friendly sometimes, and very smart. And you talk about that in your book.
Well, I talk a little bit about a group of five that came regularly. Actually, I'd put it out for ravens, because I've been studying ravens for quite a number of years, and I wanted to see the differences in the behavior between the crows and the ravens, and it was quite interesting to see the differences. But then I also mentioned an interesting thing just down the road. Somebody had noted crows apparently murdering one other one. They ganged up on one and killed it. So, you know, I got into the idea of what kind of a character are they? They're very friendly birds. And I used to have them as pets when I was a kid. I had pet crows, and they're just wonderful very attached to you and following me around. And I would go down the road, and the crows would be flying over. I'd call them, and they'd circle down and land on my shoulder. So it was a lot of fun. So, yeah, I really like crows.
How do you get them? How they land on your shoulder?
Yeah, these were birds that I'd raised, you know, and I just mm-hmm. fed them, and they hung out around the house, and, you know, after a while they were independent, but they would still come by once in a while and visit, and especially when I was jogging down the road in the vicinity, people were kind of amazed to see a crow come out of the sky and land on me.
Well, you need your own show, I think. I'm talking with Baird Heinrich. He's a professor of biology at the University of Vermont. And he's got a great book out now, One Wild Bird at a Time, Portraits of Individual Lives. And he lives up in the mountains of western Maine. And he talks about watching what you can learn from just watching and making pals with one bird or flock of birds. What surprised you most about watching individual birds that you would not have expected?
I guess one of them would be, I mean, a lot of times I couldn't really solve the total puzzle. In other words, I couldn't study them forever, but I got insights into what might be happening, not necessarily always to scientific proof, but until I had a pretty good idea. For example, I was looking at blue-headed vireos. I was trying to photograph them at the nest, and I build a blind and to get closer to the nest, and then after I build it, the birds apparently I was in there, wouldn't let me photograph, and then I found another nest where I eventually was able to lift the female off the nest with my fingers. She was so tame and had no blind whatsoever. Anyway, so it was very bad weather, and I saw the eggs number disappearing, and I realized a lot of bird nests were being destroyed because they couldn't find food, and here this bird was reducing the eggs, and it looked like kind of birth control to allow the few to live.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's quite interesting. I think I can see if I can get one phone call in. Let's go to Brooklyn, New York. Tony, hi, welcome.
Good afternoon. How are you?
Fine. How are you?
Excellent. Listen, I'm on Paddygate Basin in Brooklyn. It goes into Jamaica Bay at the Wildlife Refuge, and I've had a boat in here for the last 10 years, and there's been a male swan here for that 10 years. And over that time, it had two different females with it. One, unfortunately, went under the docks to get the food and got hung up in a rope and drowned. Mm-hmm. But that bird had been around for at least 5 years, and I never saw any babies. And now it's got a new female that stays with it and for another 2 or 3 years now, and there's still no babies. And I was wondering, I've actually seen a mate right in front of the club. So... Yeah, I'm wondering what might be going on there, if the gentleman would know.
All right, Tony, I'll ask. What do you think?
Okay. Well, it's hard to know, but it's possible that there are predators around. I know there's a goose that always nests on a little island here, pond nearby. And every time they get ready to hatch, a raccoon or something goes over there and destroys it. So the raccoons live long, too. And they know, if they always come back to the same place, they know where the nest is, and they know how good eggs taste, especially with little chicks inside. So that's one potential.
That's one possibility. Okay. Yeah. I want to talk about the birds, but I also want to talk about the bees. You can't talk about the birds without talking about the bees. Just like you might be watching birds in the wild, have you ever thought about watching wild honeybees? And not just watching them, but capturing, tagging, and tracking the bees back to their hives. Sounds cool? Sound a little dangerous to you? Well, that's exactly what Thomas Seeley, biology professor at Cornell, does. Tom has been studying bees for 40 years, and his latest book, Following the Wild Bees, The Craft and Science of Bee Hunting, is a how-to guide for finding wild bees and finding their nests. And he says it's a treasure hunt on which anyone can embark, no matter where you live. You can see a video of some parts of this treasure hunt on our website at sciencefriday.com/birdsbees. Professor Seeley, welcome back to Science Friday.
My pleasure to be back with you, Ira.
You know, in the video that we have on our website, you actually you capture some bees, you bring them back to like your folding chair, and you take out a red marker and mark the bees, and they don't seem to mind it at all.
No, it's when you're bee hunting, you're offering the bees a wonderful free lunch, so they're really happy. They're not disturbed at all. And that's part of why you can do this and why this is a fun sport to do. It's not dangerous. You don't get stung. And you have the pleasure of discovering something out in the wild.
And you're right.
A colony of bees.
Yeah, and you can... So what do? You just follow with your compass what direction they're flying back, and you keep moving your chair closer to the hive until you find the hive?
Yeah, there's really five steps to it. You've described the first one, where you catch some bees, you introduce them to a wonderful food source. Usually it's a comb filled with diluted honey or sugar syrup. Then you label some of those bees, as you pointed out. Once you've got a good bunch of bees going back and forth, and the first bees that you introduce to the food source, they go home and they share the news of this wonderful free lunch with their dances to bring other bees. Once you've got a good traffic of bees going back and forth, then you take, you look at the bee line, the direction of the bee line, the flight line home of those bees. And because you've got your bees labeled with paint marks for individual identification, you can also measure how much time they spend away between visits to the feeder. And that gives you an indication of the distance as well. And then once you have a good sense of the direction and an approximate sense of the distance, you pick up your apparatus, including your folding chair, and you move a couple hundred yards to another clearing in the direction of their home. And step by step, you work your way back to the back to their home, back to their bee tree.
Yeah, so you're saying that, you know, don't be afraid of being stung. It's not that risky. The bees are not after you.
That's right. And this is really, bee hunting stands in contrast to beekeeping in a number of ways. And when you're a beekeeper, you're dealing with a whole colony of bees. You're often opening up the hive and so disturbing the bees. And you're looking at thousands and thousands of bees. When you're a bee hunter, you're not disturbing the bees. You're giving them something really nice, and you're dealing with a handful of bees. So you get to know them as individuals, like the birds you were talking about before.
Talking with Tom Seeley, author of Following the Wild Bees, The Craft and Science of Bee Hunting, on Science Friday from PRI. This is quite interesting. What happens when you find the nest or the hive? Should you just tamper? You know, people want to go out and touch it. Is that a bad thing to do?
Well, one thing I want to stress is that in bee hunting, the allure lies in the chase, not in a kill. You don't steal honey from the wild colonies these days. That used to be, and humans have been doing that for thousands and thousands of years, and that was the original purpose of bee hunting. But today, we locate the wild colonies partly to just enjoy the pleasure of completing a hunt. It's a lot like geocaching in that regard, the pleasure, except that the clues don't come from honeybees instead of from human beings. But we also use the wild colonies that we locate to better understand what's going on with honeybees in the wild. We know a lot about the problems that beekeepers are having with their managed colonies of honeybees, but until recently, we've known very little about this whole population of wild colonies, which are living out all on their own, exposed to natural selection from these new diseases and so forth. And that's proving to be a fascinating story in itself.
Bernd Heinrich, your own professional work was in bees before you retired. Do you ever do any bee searching, like bee hunting like that?
Yeah, I sure did. When I was a kid, that's how I got into bees. I was lining bees when I was a teenager and doing just exactly as Tom is explaining. And as he said, you know, it's an old art there. It's kind of not very popular right now, but I think it's a wonderful thing to do. And it's a lot of fun to learn a lot about bees. And so I really got fascinated about especially the communication of bees, how they can, when you line the bees, you let it go, and it finds its way back, and usually others will come there before the marked bee comes back. So they've been told at the hive where the food is, and that information is transmitted, and that's what really caught me with bees. But I worked some with honeybees, swarms, but mostly with temperature regulation and physiology of bumblebees and behavior, too.
Well, that brings me to a good question from one of our listeners. I want to go to the phones to Angie in Santa Cruz, California. Hi, Angie.
Hi.
Hi there. Quickly.
Yes, I had a question about the bee hunting from Dr. and maybe Dr. Heinrich can speak to this too, but if they have any techniques or tactics for finding the other native bees that exist aside from bees, perhaps bumblebees or other kinds of bees.
Okay. What about that? What about that, Tom? Can you track other kinds of bees that way too?
Yes. Bumblebees are a really good comparison. They, even though they don't recruit, they will go back and forth. You can introduce them just in the same way you do with honeybees, and they will lock in on your rich food source, and then you can trail them back as well. And they're so big and they fly so slowly, it's actually relatively easy to line them back to their nests. I've also done it with yellow jackets. The other bees, which live in a solitary fashion, we usually just find those by looking, studying the ground or studying twigs or putting out blocks of wood with holes in them to find their nests.
Okay, well, it's quite fascinating. Watching the videos, reading the books, let me just remind everybody that we're talking with Bernd Heinrich and Tom Seeley about tracking bees and about birds. Following the Wild Bees, The Craft and Science of Bee Hunting is Tom Seeley's book. And Bernd Heinrich is One Wild Bird at a Time, Portraits of Individual Lives. So we're gonna continue our conversation on number 844-724-8255. Take a short break. We'll be right back. Don't go away. This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. In case you're just joining us, I'm talking with Thomas Seeley, professor at Cornell University, author of Following the Wild Bees, the Craft and Science of Bee Hunting. And Barrett Heinrich is biology professor emeritus at the University of Vermont. He's the author of One Wild Bird at a Time, Portraits of Individual Lives. And the thing I think both you gentlemen have in common is observation. I mean, the joy of observation. It just seems like you do it as a hobby for the fun of it.
How true. It's really true.
Yes. Yeah, it's. But usually it gets really fun when you have a problem that you're trying to solve, like, you know, Tom, tracing where the hive might be. You go for by little clues, little steps at a time. You get a hypothesis and you test it. It's just really a lot like doing science, which is kind of observations and experiments, and basically the same process with watching individual birds. Only you have a specific problem you're trying to solve, and with my different birds, I usually had some enigma that I wanted to solve. It wasn't a bee tree, but it was an enigma. Nevertheless, some little problem to solve.
Tom,
yeah, these are.
I'm sorry. Go ahead.
I was just going to say. Yeah, these are in all of these situations. You're solving mysteries, where the bees are, how the birds live out their lives, etc.
Tom, is there any common beginner's mistake if we want to do bee hunting?
Oh, let's see.
Is it, do people think it'll go a lot faster? Because it takes some time. You write in your book about a nest that took you 3 years to find.
Yeah, that was the extreme. That was a tough one. And especially working through the winters, that was terrible. No, that's a joke. No, that's a really good point. One of the things one learns as a bee hunter is that this does take time. I can usually find my bee tree. I can get my bee tree in a day, but it's not a real quick process. But that's part of the pleasure because so much of the enjoyment is observing close up these bees coming to you and flying over the trees and over the hills, and you're just marveling at their ability to find their way over such great distances and bring their hive mates to your little tiny little food source. It's about the size of a saucer. It's just a dot on the landscape.
Amazing navigational feats.
Exactly.
Yeah, Tom Seeley, biology professor at Cornell University. His latest book, Following the Wild Bees, The Craft and Science of Bee Hunting. If you want to try something new this season, this spring, it's a great idea. Thank you, Tom, for coming back and talking with us again.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Barrett Heinrich is biology professor emeritus at the University of Vermont. He's the author of One Wild Bird at a Time, Portrait of Individual Lives, and it celebrates the joy of observing and give you some hints on how you might do this yourself. Thank you, Barrett, for joining us today.
Thank you very much, Ira. It's been a great pleasure.
For some people, spring is not about the birds and the bees. It's about the mushrooms. That's right. Morel mushrooms are in season here in New York and at similar latitudes. And that season is continuing to move northward as the weeks pass. And these wild mushrooms are considered such a delicacy that they can easily sell for more than $30 a pound. They're also hard to find. They grow in woods and generally associated with only a few different kinds of trees. SciFri's Christy Taylor joined a group of morel hunters last weekend on their quest for the elusive fungus, and she came back a little scratched up, but with a big bag of mushrooms for me to saute, and I can tell you now, they were delicious. Thanks. Bring them back. Christy's here in the studio right now. Hi, welcome.
Hey, how's it going?
Tell us about what happened. Take us on a little tour of your trip.
Sure. Well, first we drove for quite a while in a direction away from New York City, and we went into the woods, and we started looking for elm trees and apple trees, which are some of the trees that morels are associated with, at least in this part of the country. So there was a lot of scrambling over rocks. There was a lot of pushing through undergrowth, and I didn't get any ticks, so
that's
was great.
Good news, yes.
And we came back with some mushrooms.
Mm-hmm. In fact, you put a little audio package together for us.
Yes, I did. So this is audio with some members of the New York Mycological Society, Tom Bigelow, Juniper Perlis, and Ethan Krenson. They were very kind to invite me along on their trip with them. Let's listen.
Leaves, roots, moss-covered stones, brambles, lots of brambles.
It's what looks to be an impenetrable thicket of brambles and brush, and we're going to try to push through. Tom Bigelow, I'm the president of the New York Mycological Society, and I've been a member in hunting morels for 8 years, I guess.
Oh, this is so stressful. My nervous system is cranked up.
The Esculenta is the morel that everyone wants.
Oh, I see a morel, big morel, right next to these antilomas.
That's just like, it's like a refrigerator magnet version of a morel. So perfect.
There's a meaty richness to it that when you mix it with a little butter, a little cream, a little nutmeg and pepper, it's just unlike anything.
It's beauty. It really is a worthy find.
There's that that rush, that thrill of seeing one, and then suddenly you start seeing them everywhere.
You found one?
Yeah, very small.
Hooray!
Two.
Yay! They're here. Tom, they're wide and far, and lots of them. Oh my God, it's so big! Hooray!
It's hit or miss, though, so it's kind of an insanity looking for them in places like this. Their existence is fleeting, they're elusive, and it's exciting when you have a big bag of them like this. I'm always relieved when morel season is over, because I don't have to subject myself to this anymore.
Christy, it sounds like such terrible torture.
It was a lot of fun, I will say, but it was an entire day of looking for mushrooms, and we only came back with one meal's worth a piece, basically. Yeah. So it was a lot of work for a small number of mushrooms.
Well, I feel very fortunate that you gave me some of those mushrooms, and I sauteed them up in a little bit of butter and some onions and whatever, and they were just delicious. I've never had anything like that.
That's why it was such a secret where exactly I went, Ira.
So you are sworn to secrecy.
Yes, basically. That is Tom and Juniper's spot, at least as far as anyone who knows them is concerned. If I wanted to go back, I would have to ask their permission every single time I went, probably. And that's etiquette. They're very hard to find, so it's really great when you find that perfect spot.
Are they all spread out? Is it a wide area, or are they all under a clump of trees or a brush in one spot?
So they're associated with the roots of the tree, so the farthest away from a tree we found one would be maybe 30 or 40 feet. So it was really about that one tree and then finding sort of where they had spread around that tree.
Mm-hmm. Well, that was good hunting, Chris. Thank you for going out and finding those mushrooms for us.
My pleasure.
Christy Taylor, our Science Friday producer, on out there in the wilds. Well, maybe morels aren't your cup of tea or just sound like too much trouble. Well, luckily, there are other edible mushrooms you can go in search of right now or soon, depending on where you live. Just make sure you do it safely. So how do you know a good mushroom from a poisonous one? For advice on safe and fruitful mushroom hunting, we turn to Gary Linkoff, a mycologist, a mushroom hunter and author of the Audubon Society Field Guide to North American Mushrooms. He joins us in our studios here in New York. Welcome to Science Friday.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Is it dangerous to go out and pick mushrooms?
For beginners, it's just a matter of learning a few of the basic rules of the road, as it were. And you look for the ones that you either cannot mistake or that are so conspicuous that if you see them, you sort of know them on sight. So we look for the easy ones, and especially the ones that are large and fleshy and edible. So if you find a really rare mushroom that happens to be edible but is really small, it's worthless. Whereas if you can find oyster mushrooms or chicken of the woods mushrooms, you're talking about 20 or 30 pounds for a given mushroom on a given tree. That is quite a haul.
That is. So how do you know that your mushrooms that you're seeing are the safe ones to eat? Do you look through your catalog?
Well, I wrote The Complete Mushroom Hunter, which is a book really for beginners. And I go through something like, say, Central Park in New York City, which I use as an indicator park. If the mushroom is growing there, it's growing everywhere.
I've heard that song. That's right.
Right. So you can, if you see the oyster mushrooms, they're growing up a tree, let's say a beech tree or a willow, you know it's going to be just about everywhere you go. And the oyster mushroom and chicken of the woods grow all across North America. It's not like you have to just in one small area. These are widespread mushrooms that come up, especially in the spring. So that's why we're out. And those of us who are disappointed at not finding morels, the compensation is we often find oyster mushrooms or chicken of the woods, and pound for pound, we get a lot more meals from those mushrooms than the morel.
Do the poisonous ones have anything in common that you can stay away from?
You can notice about them. Yeah, it's better to know the mushroom you're looking for than to just pick mushrooms and hope you can identify it. So you learn them one at a time. And so what we recommend everywhere is that people join mushroom clubs. And there are clubs in every state of the United States. And there are regular walks, and they're usually posted on websites. So there's all kinds of ways for people to connect with people who are going out looking for mushrooms. And it's better to go in a group than go by yourself.
That's interesting. You go online and find a group that may be near you. Do you have a website you might suggest to us?
Oh, well, sure. My website, which is GaryLinkoff.com. And I post walks that are going to be held both in the local area and around the country.
I'm Ira Flatow. This is Science Friday from PRI Public Radio International. Talking with Gary Linkoff, a mycologist. A mycologist, by definition, is a mushroom expert?
A person that studies mushrooms and fungi, yes.
Mm-hmm. Hey, is it true that most of the mushrooms, that in speaking now about the biology of a mushroom, that the mushroom is sort of the flower of the fungus that's underground?
Well, the fruiting body.
The fruiting body.
The fruiting body of what is usually not visible. It's in a tree, or it's in underground, or it's in mulch, for example, wood mulch.
Mm-hmm. And so it's a huge object, technically.
Right. Technically, the vegetative part can spread out for 100 yards, perhaps, but the actual mushroom is going to be relatively small, the fruiting body.
How easy is it to grow your own mushrooms?
Different mushrooms have different requirements. Some are as simple as drilling a hole in an oak log and filling it with the what's called the mycelium of a particular, like a shiitake mushroom.
Mm-hmm.
And then nature takes over and it fruits for you.
Wow, that's terrific. Let's see if I can go to the phones and get a phone call or two in here. Let's go to Dan in Davis, California. Hi, Dan.
Hi. I just had a little comment about seeing the mushrooms. I go for morels quite a bit in the foothills of California here. And often I'm surrounded by them, but I don't see them until I see one. And when I see one, I think that's something to my pattern recognition, and I suddenly see them everywhere.
Yeah, Gary's nodding his head about
that
one.
Right.
That's how it works?
You have to find the first one. That's right. It's also true for other things like black trumpets around here. Very hard to see, but once you see one, you simply stop, and you get down. Literally, you start poking around and looking, staring at the ground, and then you see others.
We've heard advice before about avoiding guild mushrooms.
Right.
Talk about that.
Oh, even though the common mushroom sold in the market, which is called the white button mushroom or the portobello or the cremini, those have gills. They have these knife blades on underneath the cap. Those are edible. The group of those kinds of mushrooms include many that are really poisonous, even deadly. So non-gilled mushrooms are much safer for the beginner. So things like the morel or the chicken mushroom, for example, the chicken mushroom is a bracket or a shelf fungus, is just way safer than trying to say, well, I think I know what this is. I'm pretty sure I'm going to feed it to my family. And that would be a really big mistake.
So that's interesting because you're right. When we buy those button mushrooms in the store, they all have the gills on them. And we say, well, we find one that's not open because it's fresher. But out a wild, stay away from those.
It's until you really are familiar with the whole life cycle of each of these mushrooms. And again, doing it with a group is safer than doing it by yourself.
And is this the season to go out now?
This is the real beginning of the regular mushroom season, which runs generally in the east from May until the end of October, and then usually begins out in California with the rains in November and runs until March or April. I just came back from Yosemite, and morels were fruiting in Yosemite.
Wow.
I mean, come on. Whoa.
Doesn't get better than that. Thank you very much for taking time to talk with us, Gary.
Thank you.
Gary Lingoff, a mycologist, mushroom hunter, and author of the Audubon Society Field Guide to North American Mushrooms. If you want to know your mushrooms, there it is. He's holding up a copy for me.
The Complete Mushroom Hunter.
All right.
Yeah,
That's what we're going to look for. And if you need more mushrooms, you want to collect them all, we made some fungus trading cards, including the jack-o'-lantern mushrooms, whose bioluminescent gills glow in the dark. And you can get them at sciencefriday.com/mushroom cards if you want to see that too. One last note. A few weeks ago, we said that the FDA had approved fecal transplants for C. diff infections. Well, we got a note from listener Rachel Sachs at Harvard saying it's not technically approved, but the FDA doesn't go after companies or doctors who perform the fecal transplant. Thank you, Rachel, for that correction. Charles Berkowitz, our director. Our senior producer is Christopher Intagliata. Our producers are Alexa Lim, Annie Minoff, Christy Taylor. Luke Raskin is our video producer. Our digital team includes Julie Liebach, Chow Tu, Brandon Echter, and Daniel Peterschmidt. Rich Kim is our technical director, and Jack Horowitz is our engineer this week at the controls here at the studios of our production partners, the City University of New York. Happy mushroom and bee hunting this weekend. Looks like a good one for it. I'm Ira Flatow in New York.